Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Go everywhere today on the Brian Lehrer Show. It's a family meeting on travel.
Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun. I'm going to have fun, and you're going to have fun.
So when is travel just a getaway? When is it just fun? And when is it a quest? And when do you want each? We'll hear your epic travel fail stories today. And while you might remember some of those trips fondly anyway, when is travel ethical? Where wouldn't you go and why? And if you're a black or brown American, how differently are you treated when you travel abroad? Has that experience opened your eyes in some way about living here? It's a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on travel at the beginning of this summer travel season. And let's get it going with a fill in the blank for the first few minutes. I really haven't traveled unless I what? I haven't really traveled unless I what? What is that for you? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I haven't really traveled unless I want. One of them for me is I haven't really traveled unless I drove on a dirt road. That's because I tend to go to the country when I travel, less to cities, although that's been actually changing for me in the last few years. But since I live in Manhattan, one of the things I sometimes measure travel by is how deeply I get away from what we loosely call civilization. And I don't go booking motel rooms or campsites based on proximity to dirt roads per se. I'm not that extreme. But early on, I realized I would often run into one in the places I tended to go to hike or bike. Or see different places, and it became a marker in my mind. So I haven't really traveled unless I drove on a dirt road. And it was a little like that for Chris McCandless, talking to a guy he meets in the movie Into the Wild. Remember?
Alaska, Alaska. I'm going to be all the way out there, all the way on my own. You know, no watch, no map, no axe, no nothing. Just be out there in it. You know, big mountains, rivers, sky, game. Just be out there in it, you know, in the wild. You know?
In the wild.
Just in the wild.
Yes. Just, what are you doing when we're there? Now you're in the wild.
Just,
what are you doing?
You're just living, man. You're just there in that moment, in that special place and time.
Yeah.
Maybe when I get back, I can write a book about my travels.
Why
you know,
not?
About getting out of this sick society.
Society, man.
Society. You know, society.
So it wasn't a trip for them until they got away from this sick society. What is it for you? I haven't really traveled unless I what? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. We've been asking the question on Twitter, and some of what we've got included, I haven't really traveled until I need a vacation from the vacation. Huh. I haven't really traveled unless I forget or lose the bag with the toothpaste, deodorant, shampoo, whatever. Or I haven't really traveled unless I get some mileage in, writes Eric on Twitter. One of my colleagues here, whose identity I'll keep secret to protect the obsessed, he would say, I haven't really traveled unless I visited a minor league baseball stadium. What is it for you? 212-433-WNYC. For Thelma of Thelma and Louise, it wasn't until she let her hair down. Remember?
I'll have a wild turkey straight up and a Coke back, please.
Thelma!
Oh, what? Tell me something. Is this my vacation or isn't it? I mean, God, you're as bad as Daryl.
Sorry, it's just I'm not used to seeing you this way. I haven't seen you this way in a while. You're usually so sedate.
Well, I've had it up to my ass with sedate. You said you and me was going to get out of town and for once just really let our hair down. Well, darling, look out, because my hair is coming down.
Gina Davis as Thelma. It wasn't a trip for her until her hair came down. A little different than for Audrey Hepburn in 1953 as a princess in Roman Holiday, who just wanted a normal day.
I'd like to do just whatever I like, the whole day long.
Things like having your hair cut.
I like to sit at a sidewalk cafe and look in shop windows, walk in the rain, have fun and Maybe some excitement. Doesn't seem much to you, does it?
It's great. Tell you what, why don't we do all those things together?
But don't you have to work?
Now, today's going to be a holiday. First wish, one sidewalk cafe coming right up.
So it wasn't a trip for a princess until she achieved the truly mundane. Here, maybe a haircut while Thelma was letting her hair down. Sidewalk cafe. How about for you? I haven't really traveled unless I what? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. And Tracy in Soho, you haven't really traveled unless you what?
Gotten lost.
Ha, good one. Has it happened to you?
Oh, yeah. We, you know, my husband and I, when we do travel, starting with our honeymoon, you know, we love it when we misread the map because we find things that we weren't expecting. And, you know, we'll find our way back eventually or not, but that makes for the most fun.
You found yourself your way back eventually because you're here. You got a story? Tell me a getting lost story.
We were on our honeymoon, and we were in Ireland, and we were trying to drive up to the highest sea-facing cliffs of Europe, ostensibly. And we drove, and the paved road turned into a dirt road, turned into two ruts in the grass, and then we got out and pushed open gates and moved past the sheep and climbed and got to the top of the cliff that we were supposed to be looking at, but we were on it, and we could see the car park down below. And it was kind of better than the wedding day. It was a moment where we found ourselves completely alone at the edge of the world, or so it felt. And we wouldn't have found it had we been paying attention to the map.
Great. Tracy, thank you very much. All right, Dan in Manhattan, you haven't really traveled unless you what?
Unless I've been invited to sleep over a stranger's house.
Has it happened?
All kinds of times. I was driving cross country a bunch of years ago, living out of my van for a few months, and I met this old Texas guy and his girlfriend in a beautiful van with a great airbrush lady and tiger on the beach on the side. And we had a nice little conversation, and it turned out he was a repo man, and we talked, and he brought me back to his place, and we drank beers, and I slept on a waterbed with a big tiger print cover, and then we went up the next day and went repossessing cars together.
Went out with a repo man. There's a vacation. Dan, thank you very much. Liz in Rockland County, you haven't really traveled unless you what? Liz, you there?
Oh, hi. How are you? Yes, I am. I haven't really traveled unless I have lost complete Wi-Fi or data service on my phone.
And best of all, if you tried to get it and you couldn't.
It depends on who. If it's me, I'm relieved. If my children are there, they get very frustrated because they've never lived without the Internet.
Liz,
it's crazy.
Thank you very much. She hasn't traveled unless her kids are going crazy from losing their Wi-Fi. Dolores in Bloomfield, you haven't really traveled unless you what?
You know, read up on where I'm going.
Oh.
You really have to, and especially afterwards, if you haven't done a thorough little investigation, you either read about the place you've been in a story or see it and think, I was there. You know, it's much more interesting if you know a lot more about where you're going.
So this is the epilogue. I haven't really traveled unless I've come back and followed up. Do you have an example?
No. Well, no, because I haven't traveled that much, and the little bit I've done, I realize that I've kind of wasted it. No, not traveling afterwards, but I mean reading afterwards, but reading before, so that when you see it, when you're there, you think, this is where that happened, and, you know, you get so much more out of it if you know the history of the place.
Dolores, thank you very much. Joe in Tenafly, you haven't really traveled unless you what?
Unless I've heard either another language or at very least a different dialect of English. I know I've traveled in a lot of different places in the world and find it really interesting to hear the music of other languages. But this weekend I'm just going to be going up to New Hampshire. I live in the New York area, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some of the voices I'll hear up there, and they just are, you know, have this different warm rhythm, a sound and rhythm to them. And I find that really, you know, that lets me know I moved. I changed location.
That's a great one. I once took a bus trip. When I was right out of college, I wanted to visit a friend in San Francisco, and the only way I could get from New York to San Francisco that I could afford was by bus. And I was 72 hours on a Greyhound bus, and it was the first time I'd ever been west of Buffalo. And it was such a revelation to me as people got on and either sat next to me and we struck up conversations or just sat near me and I listened to them when we got into Ohio and people sounded different. And then we got further into the Midwest and people sounded different. And then we were in Wyoming and people sounded different. And yeah, you know, there are these different accents, but then there are these real people sitting next to you on a bus, really talking like that. And all I was doing was sitting on a Greyhound bus for 3 days. But I had that experience that I was really traveling in another place because I heard that slightly different dialect of English.
Of course, that can happen to you on a crosstown bus, too, but it's a little different.
Certainly in New York, but a little different. Thank you very much. Celia in Rivervale, you haven't really traveled unless what?
I have traveled with a pack of relatives.
Unless you've traveled with a pack of your own relatives.
Yes, yes. It started out when our daughters were very little. We started taking trips with my parents, and every year we went abroad with them. Then we added my mother-in-law when my father-in-law passed away, and we continued traveling all through, you know, while they were in college. And the best thing that happened was a couple of years ago, my daughter, who now has children, said to me, Mom, I want to go traveling with you and Daddy because I want my kids to have the same experience we had when we traveled together.
Even though you realize a lot of people go traveling to get away from their relatives.
I know. We couldn't think of going without them because my parents were the ones who first introduced us to traveling. And we knew that they would love to be with us, and we enjoyed being with them. So we just included them.
That's great. Celia, that's Celia from America's Only Functional Family. Celia, thanks for your call. Elle in Essex County, you haven't really traveled unless you what?
Have forgotten all of my work passwords and logon IDs.
I hope you write them down, for one thing.
Oh, absolutely, because if you go in on Monday morning after a vacation and you remember how to turn the computer on and you remember all your logons and all your passwords, you have not vacationed well.
So is this a reflection of the length of your vacation because it takes a certain amount of time to forget your passwords, or is it not that?
It's just that you've completely put work out of your mind. You're not thinking about computers. You're a completely different mindset, and you come in Monday morning and you say, how do I turn this on? Where's the button? Then you know that you've gotten your mind off of things.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The length of time reminds me that that's another one of mine, or it's been for a long time. Regular listeners to this show in the summer know that I tend to take 2 weeks off in August and have gone to the Adirondacks many, many years in a row. And when I started doing that, I did it for 1 week. And I quickly realized it wasn't really a vacation unless I settled in for 2 weeks. Now, that wasn't so much traveling as going and settling in by a place. But that second week, oh, my goodness, talk about forgetting your passwords. What a difference it can make. Bernadette in Queens, you haven't really traveled unless you what?
Unless you relived your childhood memories.
Really?
We take traveling. You know, I take when just to smell a lake that brings back a memory when you were there with your parents, or to get into the car and it, you know, we used to drive in the backseat of the station wagon down 95 to Florida and Alligator Alley just to smell the salt air and stay in the little Sheratons. So I pack up my kids and we go up to the mountains. We have a house up in the mountains, and just to smell the moisture and relive childhood memories. I've been dragging my kids for 26 years. They still complain a little bit, but they know that it's memories that we had, you know, the smells of different places, the food in little shops that are still around. And every time you relive a childhood memory, it's like a real travel in your mind and your soul, and it's a great vacation. Like,
and
you
so
saying,
you're the opposite of a few of the people who've called in and said it's not real. I haven't really traveled unless I've done something really new.
No, it's just, I think traveling just brings a peace to you because that's what you're looking for. So when you find that peace of things that bring happy thoughts and memories and places, your body just like settles down and you feel comfortable in your travels, which is all that's in your mind.
Thank you, Bernadette. Shia in Brooklyn, you really haven't traveled until you what?
Until I checked in on Foursquare in the new place.
Checked in on Foursquare in the new place.
Yeah, and also until I take a photo and add it to my Instagram, map. So when I come back, I can see on my map the new place that I have photos in.
Shia the digital collector, what do you say to the woman who called and said it isn't really a vacation until she can't get Wi-Fi anymore?
That's the worst, because the first thing when I come to a new place, I need to check in that I'm there so everyone knows I'm there. And I have it on my history and my maps that I was in that location. Think about it. It used to be that you used to bring back pictures and put it on your pin board, on your board, or your map. Now the new way is you put it on Instagram, and when you open up your map, you see all your photos where you were.
Shia, the connected traveler. Thank you very much. Bob in Rego Park, you haven't really traveled until you what?
Hey, Brian, how you doing, guy? You know, as you probably know, I'm a yoga teacher. I love to meditate. I haven't really traveled, and I'm not talking about physical place. I'm talking about going within, experiencing the bliss of your own self, and the physical location doesn't matter. You could go to a yoga retreat, or you could have a fight with your wife. It's within you that you'll find this bliss and serenity.
Hasn't really traveled until he's found his inner bliss. That's a high bar. Omar in Somerset, you haven't really traveled until you what?
Until you start to miss your local cuisine.
Ooh, until you start to miss your local cuisine. Has it happened to you?
Yeah, a couple of times where I have a tendency to immerse myself whenever I travel, and the best way to immerse yourself in any culture, even in different states across the country, is with the food.
To eat the food.
And I get into it. I don't experiment a whole lot, but I do get into it. I mean, I took a colleague up to Rochester on business, and we went, you know, they're known, that whole area is known for the wings. I believe you're from Buffalo, so you know that.
No, I'm from here, but I lived in Albany, but go ahead.
Yeah, and I went to Syracuse, so, you know, up that way, it's all about the wings. And, we had, like, a trough of wings, and we were so into it. And I was, you know, but then, even when I go overseas, when we went to Portugal, I ate so much seafood that I couldn't wait to come back home and just have an Italian hero, you know. So,
right, until I've been so long eating the local food that I miss, the home food. Omar, thank you very much. And Linda in Verona, kind of along those lines, Linda?
Yeah, I agree with the last caller, and I love the one about, you know, forgetting your password. That's so true.
I can't believe, by the way, it took until...
I think you haven't traveled until you have... my husband and I like to plan our own trips and not do the tours. So until you've gone off the beaten path and tried the wines of the country and experience, really, like you said, immerse yourself in the culture of the country and not just stay in your hotel or eat, I mean, follow the tourist trip, you know, path. I mean, I really believe that we love adventure. We love to meet the people that live in the country and talk to them and really immerse ourselves in the culture.
And so until you've tasted the country's wine is where you started on this.
What was a
wine that surprised you? From where?
Well, actually, we were in Portugal and recently, and I loved the wine. And I wrote the name down, and I wasn't able to soak the bottle or anything because I was in a restaurant and get the label off. So I just wrote it down, and I came back, and then I was able to buy it here. And I actually was... and continued the adventure of trying to find the Portuguese wine here in this country. And I found the Portuguese coffee and, you know, which I also love, and ordered some here so I could have it at home.
Linda, thank you very much. I went and found a bourbon in Florida that I then could not find in New York. How about that? Didn't think the wings were going to be that different in Rochester or the liquor that different in the panhandle of our southernmost state. So thank you, Linda. Thanks to all of you. I can't believe it took until after a quarter past the hour for food to even come up. But coming up next, when has your travel risen to the level of a quest? We'll hear from Cheryl Strayed, author of the book Wild and Your Travel Quest Stories. Stay with us.
Tired of traveling alone.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show, family meeting about travel. And let's talk now about the most profound travel experience you've ever set out to have, about travel as a quest. Tell us a story of a time your travel rose to the level of a pilgrimage or a quest. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. A few years ago, we had the photographer Annie Leibovitz on the show, who wrote a book called Pilgrimage, and we took calls specifically on the related idea of the pilgrimage. Many of you, it turned out, had gone on one.
I had made a pilgrimage to Granada, Spain, to visit the house of Federico García Lorca.
I have two pilgrimage places, one in honor of the God-sent abolitionist, Reverend John Brown. I visit the former federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry.
We went to Georgia O'Keeffe's house. Really, viscerally felt like I was in her space. I was inside a photograph.
I visited a small cemetery with 40 graves in it on land that was purchased by some Scots-Irish ancestors of mine.
Some of your pilgrimage stories. We will talk to Cheryl Strayed in a minute, who went on one at a time of crisis in her life and famously wrote about it in her book Wild. But Cheryl Strayed and I want to know about your pilgrimage or your quest. 212-433-WNYC. What was the deepest reason you ever set out to travel? And did you find what you were looking for? 212-433-WNYC. Maybe you've gone on a religious pilgrimage. Have you done the Hajj, the actual Hajj? Have you taken the birthright trip to Israel? I know a couple that travels around the world a bit, a Jewish couple, and they haven't traveled until they've seen a synagogue wherever they go. Gone looking for that ashram or that yogi in the Himalayas? 212-433-WNYC. And did you find what you were looking for? Or maybe you've been on a family pilgrimage. How about some of those family stories that we got in the overture to the show in the opening segment? Have you gone to the town of your immigrant grandparents' birth? Something I want to do and haven't done yet. Tell us a story of your pilgrimage to your roots. And what does the travel have to do with it? Why does the act of going to a different place open us up the way it does? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Have you gone on a pilgrimage to discover something outside of yourself, or more on a pilgrimage to discover something about yourself? Maybe like my friend here at the station, my obsessed friend, it was a pilgrimage to find the most old-fashioned, low-tech minor league baseball stadiums in America. Maybe it was a pilgrimage or a quest to find out or to find what you didn't even know you were looking for. Tell us your best quest story. What was the deepest reason you ever set out to travel for? And did you find what you were looking for? 212-433-WNYC. And to join us on this journey, we have a very special guest whose account of her own journey has inspired so many readers. Cheryl Strayed walked 1,100 miles over 3 months in 1995 and wrote the memoir Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Cheryl, so nice to have you along for this ride. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
And as you write in Wild, and as the subtitle suggests, you were at a low point in your life. You were in your 20s. You had recently lost your mother, and your marriage had ended. What made you think an 1,100-mile hike could change that, or were you even conscious that that was a goal?
Oh, absolutely. That was the goal. I had reached a low point in my life. My mom died suddenly of cancer at the age of 45 when I was a senior in college, and she was a senior in college, too, as it turns out. And it really began, just a lot of difficult things in my life. And I was in my early 20s, and that's already a difficult time for many people. They're trying to figure out who they are. And I really, looked up when I was about 26 and said, I can't go on this way. I have to gather myself and become the person I know I'm meant to be. And I needed to do something to sort of shake my life up. But I think, obviously, that's what travel does. You know, when we go out of the familiar and into the wild, and I did that literally, out of the comfort zone and into those places where you can discover who you really are. So I just decided I needed to take a big, incredible journey. And it ended up being walking for 3 months on the Pacific Crest Trail.
So you did it very consciously with that in mind. And, of course, you wrote a whole book to answer this question I'm about to ask you. But did you find essentially what you were looking for since you set out so consciously with the goal you just described? Or did you find something different?
I think that we always find something different. We set an intention. We're looking for a particular thing. And any good journey takes us on an adventure we couldn't have expected. I think that I found, in a bigger sense, what I was looking for, but I didn't know the route by which I would get it. My hike ended up being so much more physically difficult than I imagined it would be. You know, before I set out, I had this kind of Hollywood movie reel in my mind of, you know, sitting there every evening watching the sunset and weeping over its beauty and feeling connected to the universe. And instead what I got, you know, I got that, but I also got a lot of, real trials, physical trials, pain, deep solitude. I went the first 8 days of my hike without even seeing another human being. And out of those challenges, things arose, and I really learned all of those things that I needed to learn in order to do that thing I set out to do.
And I wonder if Kira in Brooklyn is especially identifying with this, considering what I think she's going to talk about. Kira, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi there, Brian. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great.
Great. My quest involved the sudden death of my sister. She actually died while attending the Burning Man Festival out in Nevada, and it was one of those, very unexpected things. It took a year because Burning Man only happens once a year, but by the time the next year came around, I kind of dropped everything in New York, quit my job, left my apartment, left everything I had going here, and kind of made my pilgrimage to Burning Man in my sister's memory.
I'm so sorry you lost your sister.
Thanks.
And so am I.
What was that like to go back and be in the place of her death?
Well, I'd never been there before, so I kind of knew a little bit about what to expect. It's all about community, and a lot of people are going there in a spiritual way. They actually build a temple at Burning Man, and I was able to make a shrine for her there and actually had her ashes there. They burn the whole thing at the end, so actually part of her ashes kind of will always be a part of that part of the desert. So it was really cathartic for me to go back and feel like I could kind of be where she'd spent her last week.
Kira, thanks so much. It's hard to get more profound than that right off the bat. Thank you for sharing that. I'm sure it's hard to talk about, too. Cheryl, did you ask her what it was like because you were wondering whether it would be more cathartic or more re-traumatizing?
Yeah, I was just curious. I do think there was a caller earlier in the show who suggested going back to childhood places to relive memories. And I think that
in a lighter, in a lighter vein.
Yes, much lighter vein. But, I mean, I think that in some ways, you know, even though Kira had never been to Burning Man, she was, you know, obviously visiting a place that had, you know, has a great importance in her life and her family's life. And, you know, I do think I think catharsis and trauma can be really close together. I mean, part of catharsis is reaching into the dark places and you know, being there and being witness to the saddest things in our lives. I don't think that that's to be avoided. I think that's the only way to get to catharsis.
Jessica in Jersey City, tell us about your quest.
Well, my quest was stemmed from childhood. I was raised, as a lot of us were, on Little House on the Prairie, both the books and TV. And I was between jobs in May of 2004 during the cicada invasion, if you recall that. And I decided, I had 6 days between jobs. I decided to take my Mini Cooper and drive to Mansfield, Missouri, where Mrs. Wilder wrote the books, and drive back. So I spent 2 days each way driving and a day and a half in Mansfield, Missouri. And it was very emotional. I mean, it brought back a lot of memories of my childhood, and it was just a very soul-stirring, deep experience.
Were other people doing something similar?
There were a lot of school groups, but I noticed a couple of, you know, approaching middle-aged single women looking a little lost. And upon connecting with two of the three of them, they all were doing the same thing. We all felt a little embarrassed until we realized how deep a connection we'd all had to these books as children, and we felt vindicated.
That's an awesome story. Thank you very much. Cheryl Strayed.
I especially love to hear that because I'm a writer. I love it that you know that your hero is a writer.
Where should people go in 50 years to remember you and make that connection with your books?
Well, you know, that's been one of the most amazing things to come out of Wild is we don't have to wait 50 years. There are people right now as we speak hiking the Pacific Crest Trail and other trails around the world because they
right.
were inspired by
right.
Wild.
Right, absolutely. And I wonder if these words mean anything or mean anything different. If you were on a quest and that last caller was on a pilgrimage, you know, that pilgrimage to the Wilder House, but you were on a quest, which was to go figure something out and find something new and break new ground. Do you see a meaning? You're a writer. As a writer, do you see a different nuance, you know, a nuanced difference between those words that has meaning?
I do. I think that there are some, you know, some striking similarities. You are ultimately, I think, seeking solace and personal growth on both those kinds of journeys. But one, you know, the quest is that you're trying to answer the questions. I mean, there's that quest means question, and you're really trying to find the answer to something. In my own case, in Wild, it really came down to how can I live without my mother? I had lost. When she died, the essential person in my life. How can I live without her? And I found the answer to that question. I think a pilgrimage is to revisit something you already know and see what more you know about it, to honor in some ways the essence of who you are. And so they're linked, but slightly different intentions.
I think Jean in St. Louis went on a quest. Hi, Jean. You're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thank you so much. Great to be here. And I can really relate to what Cheryl's saying about being on a pilgrimage and trying to find that thing inside you. And in 2011, in fact, it's 3 years ago this week, I walked off a corporate job, a middle-aged, divorced mother of four who'd finished raising kids. And mine was also, unfortunately, motivated by the death of my brother. And I'd lost two brothers inside a few short years. And I'd always intended to go back and do this road trip with them. And to revisit the places where I'd lived. I was a journalist. I'd lived around the country. And I got to a point, Brian, where I just said, I cannot do this life another day. And I quit my job. I called my kids all across the country and said, I'm bugging out. I took my dog, and we traveled 8,600 miles around the country to revisit every place and every person I'd known and loved in my life.
Wow.
And there was another mystery. There had been some very... Frankly, everybody has heartache, and there have been some very arduous times that my children and I had gone through some really difficult things. But I had a half-brother from my biological father whom I had never seen and didn't know where he was. And when my brother died in Albuquerque and I had missed the opportunity to go back and to spend more time with him, because, you know, we're distracted. We're distracted by jobs and mortgages and obligations. And I figured out that, you know, living with regret was worse than living with fear. And I thought, screw it, what do I have to lose? I've worked all my life to try to keep a roof over my head, but time's running out. And so I did this trip. I went from St. Louis in a big circle around the country. And I tell you what, I found my brother in Northern California and had never laid eyes on him. And the entire trip, frankly, changed my life.
Living with regret is worse than living with fear.
And you learn that, you know, the hard way with best intentions. Like, I wish I'd spent more time with them. I wish that I had stopped what I was doing and gone and done this when I thought about it. And, you know, I think the older we get and the more tied we get to, you know, our responsibilities and our obligations, it can be very paralyzing. And my dog, in fact, was the inspiration. I had this epiphany moment out in my front lawn when she wouldn't go after a cat because of her invisible collar or the electrical fence collar around her neck.
Right.
And she wants to go, you know, chase this cat, and she stopped short, and I'm sitting there on my front porch the day that my brother passed away, and I thought,
She's the batteries in her collar are dead. She could go after that thing that she wants, but she's afraid. And that was the day that I said, I don't care. I'm leaving. And in fact, I wrote a book about the trip, and I did a Kickstarter campaign. And I was 56 years old, so I'm not the typical Kickstarter demo. Yeah. But
so this is such an amazing story on so many levels. And I want to ask about one little piece of it. Because so here are all these conditions of your life that you've described. But the thing you went to do was to try to see everybody you've ever known in your life and every place you've ever visited in the past, if I heard you right.
Yeah.
Why that? Why were you looking for everybody you've ever known? Why was that the trip?
Because I felt like it was the thing that I longed for. I longed to go to North Carolina and Texas, New Mexico, California. I'd lived in all these places. And I wanted to find cousins I hadn't seen in 40 years to tell them that I loved them. And I wrote about this in the book, that as much as people want to go on these journeys, and I get it absolutely down to my DNA, but the folks that you go see, it makes a difference to them. If you go back and you visit them and you say, you matter to me. And I just think it's so important for us to seize those opportunities to go back and visit those folks and say, you made a difference in my life.
Incredible. Cheryl, you want to talk to your fellow memoirist at all?
Well, I just would love to read your book. But I also feel, you know, I relate to so much of what you're saying. I so much of my ability to go on that hike when I did had to do with what you just said. You know, I decided not to let fear rule me.
Right.
So often
right.
people say, how could you go out there by yourself? You know, I was alone in the wilderness, you know, for 94 days, and I was really alone. I mean, this was very remote wilderness. And they, you know, people ask, weren't you afraid? And yes, I sometimes was afraid, but mostly what I said to myself is, I am not afraid. I decided that fear would not be my ruler. And I think, of course, you know, we always have to, you know, take precautions and all of those things. I'm not talking about, you know, just throwing yourselves into the world. I'm saying, you know, so many of us don't do the things we really want to do because we decide to let fear be our ruler. And I just wasn't willing to do that. It sounds like you weren't either.
Jean, awesome. Thank you so much. You've added so much.
Sure. My book is Off the Leash.
Off the Leash.
Off the Leash,
Jean Ellen
okay.
Watley. And Cheryl, you're an inspiration, and I get where you're coming from. And I you know, bless you for all your good work. And I appreciate the opportunity
Thank
to be
you.
On the show.
And Jean, what was your last name? I think I stepped on it.
That's all right. So Jean Ellen Watley, and my book is Off the Leash, How My Dog Inspired Me to Quit My Job, Pet My Car, and Take a Road Trip Across America to Reclaim My Life.
Thank you, and good luck.
Thanks.
Elizabeth in Washington Heights, what was your quest?
Hi. You have the most incredible callers. That last call was unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
So I had always been very proud of the fact that I had been to all 62 of New York State's counties. And then one night in a fit of internet-induced insomnia, I realized, much to my mortification, I had only been to 59 of them. So I had been lying, in essence, saying that I'd been all over the state. So I made it my business in the following year to go to these other three counties. So the last, they were Allegheny, Yates, and Lewis. The last county that I went to was Lewis County, which is in the middle of the state, as I think you know. It's in the middle of the Adirondacks. There's no there. You have to be going there because that's where you're going. You wouldn't be driving through. And when I got there at, I don't know, it was about midnight, I walked into the hotel and said to the lady, is this Lewis County? And she said, yes. And I was like, great. And she looked at me like I had four noses. That who would be that excited to be in this nothing place in the town? So I explained it to her, and she thought that was pretty cool.
How had you wound up going to 59 of the 62 counties before you even thought about it in the first place?
I grew up on Long Island. I take road trips with my kids. So when they were little, we did a number of New York State road trips that included going all the way up to Plattsburgh and then driving around the hump of Lake Ontario and down to Syracuse for the state fair and over to Niagara Falls. I went to college in Buffalo. I had lots of friends in the Southern Tier. My daughter went to college in Binghamton. I've been to the Catskills and the Adirondacks. So I've crisscrossed the state. It's a big state.
Oh, yeah.
But so the next day, I really wanted to honor this sort of, well, quest, I guess, more than pilgrimage of going to all around the state. So I went to the Historical Museum of Lewis County, which, you know, it's only open 3 days a week, and fortunately the day that I was there was one of them.
And when I walked in, I explained to the guy, you know, here was my quest. So this is my last county. What have you got? This guy knew, like, everything about Lewis County and took me on an intimate tour of every weird and interesting artifact of Lewis County.
Tell me one thing before I go. Tell me one thing about Lewis County or describe one artifact, can you?
Yes. I don't remember his name, but the reason why we have the Forever Wild Adirondacks, which is the largest sort of not national park, it's a state park, is because the Secretary of Interior at the time under, I'm not going to make it up, I don't remember which president, at the turn of the in the 19th century, was from the Adirondacks and wanted to preserve that. So that's the sort of national legacy, and he was a son of Lewis County.
There you go. Great story. Elizabeth, all 62 counties in New York State. John in Queens, can you top that?
Well, a little bit. I've been to all 3,142 counties in the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
40 years ago, just after I got out of graduate school, a friend and I took an 8,000-mile trip in a Volkswagen. And when I passed into my 49th state, you know, I got this crazy idea. Well, I've been to 49 states. 50 will be easy. And then I took a look at a map of the United States with all the counties. And I said, you know, that's a quest. And so last September, I visited my two last counties up in the Aleutians. I went to Aleutians West census area, and I went to Aleutians East Borough. And it has been amazing. Actually, you and I have something in common, Brian, because in 1990 I called you and talked to you about the fact that you and I stayed at the same hotel in Denali National Park.
Oh, gosh, I remember that.
And
in fact, I remember because the show, I'll tell you
a little bit more traveling.
Wow, that's an incredible story. John, I'll just tell the listeners that the show was just 1 year old at that time. And that was like my first little taste of fame in a way that it was that somebody was actually listening, you know, and that it was getting out beyond the four corners of, you know, the most listened to blocks for public radio in New York, because that was really my first vacation. In the history of doing the show. And my wife and I went to Alaska, and we thought we were getting as far away as we could possibly get, finding the dirt roads and all of that. And the clerk, I don't think we met, but the clerk at the hotel said, oh, you're Brian Lehrer from the radio. A guy here saw your name in the guest book, and he's a listener. And I was like,
that was me.
Holy moly, at Denali. Then you've gone. So, John, after visiting all how many counties in America?
3,142. It fluctuates slightly. Things change again and now and again.
So is it like notches on the wall and I did it and I did it and I did it and
no,
I can check
no,
this one off, or is it deeper?
The most important thing about it was the travel. And, in fact, I'm not trying to promote anything. I just wrote a 13-page essay about it that I'm trying to shop around to magazines and stuff. And I call it a book of 3,142 pages. I mean, I went to the leper colony in Molokai, which is a separate county, and I had to hike down the 1,600-foot cliff path to get there.
Wow.
Of course, I was in Unalaska, which is also called Dutch Harbor, which was incredible. And then I went to a place called Cold Bay. That was my absolute last county. Turned out to be the bleakest place I've been. But I'm so glad to have done all those things. I've listened to old men in 1,000 different restaurants for breakfast, because that's where old men go in the morning, talking about local politics, local life in Iowa and in Minnesota and in Georgia and all over. I've had amazing epiphanies in places, and it's been just the most wonderful thing to do. In the meantime, I've also been to all seven continents. I have hiked the Inca Trail. I have been to the Serengeti Plains. I have been in all three of the big pyramids at Giza. I've been very lucky. I love to travel. I was an officer in the Navy in the 60s, and I've been around the world twice and things like that. So been lucky.
I thought I was good for sleeping in 45 states. Now I feel like a pipsqueak. John, thank you very much. That is awesome. And Cheryl Strayed, we're running out of time, but I know that you are going to read something for us from your book. This is a passage about the emotional journey you were on that Wild was based on. And I think you're talking about the halfway point of your trip when you had just passed a deer who reacted to you calmly. Do you want to set this up right. anymore?
Sure. Well, yeah, it is the midpoint of the journey. And I think the previous caller just used that word epiphany. And, you know, I think most journeys, what we find is we have epiphanies along the way. And so this was a moment where I guess I felt an opening. I felt that I was getting what I went out there to get. I gazed out over the darkening land. There were so many amazing things in this world. They opened up inside of me like a river. I laughed with the joy of it, and the next minute I was crying my first tears on the PCT. I cried and I cried and I cried. I wasn't crying because I was happy. I wasn't crying because I was sad. I wasn't crying because of my mother or my father or Paul. I was crying because I was full. California streamed behind me like a long silk veil. I didn't feel like a big fat idiot anymore, and I didn't feel like an Amazonian queen. I felt fierce and humble and gathered up inside, like I was safe in this world, too. And so really that was just a moment where, you know, I was out there. I'd been hiking about 50 days by that point. So many hard things had happened to me. And I'd never cried until there was this moment of beauty, of fullness. I could see that I was getting what I'd come for, which is really extraordinary.
So beautiful. And Cheryl Strayed, thanks so much for riding along and kind of being the centerpiece of this part of our family meeting on travel. People's amazing. So, and one of the callers amazing?
They were. I loved listening to all of their stories. I wish we were all sitting around the table. We could talk more. I wanted to ask them all questions.
We'll have to do this for, you know, a weekend sometime with 100,000 other people.
Or you could all go hiking with me. We could talk a lot in the woods.
I like it. Cheryl Strayed, author of Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone, on our family meeting on travel. Who's going to come out and play for a few minutes while you're on vacation? Call in and take us on your trip. Let's live in the moment and see if anyone is listening who is traveling or on vacation right now. 212-433-WNYC. We did arrange for a couple of people to call in to get this kicked off. Kate from Westchester is at Acadia National Park in Maine this week. Hi, Kate. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. I love your show.
Thank you, and thanks for giving us a few minutes for this. Where are you right now?
So right now I'm in Bar Harbor because we were in the national park but had no service, and we were looking forward to chatting. So we ran into town real quick so that we could tell your listeners about our trip.
And what would make your trip to Acadia a success?
Well, I think we've already had a success because we try to get a little bit unplugged away from the hustle and bustle and the heat. I heard how hot it is in New York, and it's about 70 degrees here. So just the relaxation and getting away from the city is nice.
What's the best thing you've done so far?
I think the best thing we've done so far is yesterday we went on a beautiful hike up Beach Mountain, which involves some ladder rungs, some heights. My boyfriend's a little bit scared, so it's always good to push yourself a little bit. And then we jumped in the Echo Lake right at the bottom of the cliff. So beautiful day in the sun and just relaxation all around.
Kate, have fun at Acadia. Thanks a lot for giving us a few minutes. Enjoy yourself.
Anytime. Thanks, Brian.
And we also have ready to go here Toby and Michelle at Disney World in Florida with their three sons. Hi, Toby. Hi, Michelle. You both there?
Just Toby here right now because we're on a cell.
So, Toby, where are you right now?
I am in the Wilderness Lodge Resort poolside with all of our luggage, unfortunately ready to head back to Amtrak and come back home to New Jersey.
You went to Florida by train?
We did, yeah. We do this. We come here maybe 1 to 3 times per year. We're Vacation Club members. And we discovered a while back that it was as economical and way more fun to drive our family to just outside of D.C. and get onto the Amtrak auto train where they load your car up. And you get sort of a bedroom, and then the kids get to hang out on the choo-choo, and so do the adults, and, you know, come overnight for 20 hours rather than driving. And then when you get here, you don't have to rent a car because you have one, you know, versus some of the chaos and the TSA and everything else. It's actually kind of a mini adventure in itself.
How old are your kids?
One is 12 weeks old, one is 3 years old, and one will be 7 in a couple of weeks.
You went to Disney World with a 12-week-old?
Oh, yeah, that's nothing. We've been here, well, pregnant a couple of times. We've been here with almost newborns. It's a challenge, especially with this many now.
It sounds like you're really into Disney World.
You know, it's funny because we've been sort of your typical Brooklynite Williamsburgers, the least likely people to love Disney our whole lives. But as soon as we started having kids, we discovered what a great place this was. They just make things so easy.
What's the best thing and what's the worst thing you did in Disney World this week?
The worst thing was definitely walking around in the I don't even know how hot heat and being the dad who has to push everybody when they're tired, which seems to be all the time. The best thing was probably watching the U.S. World Cup match yesterday in a bar at our resort full of other families with all the kids sort of mingling and having fun while the parents all cheered and then cried.
I had the experience yesterday watching the second half in the gym on the treadmill, and I've never seen anything like that because you know how the gyms are where everybody, you know, at least in the one that I belong to, has your own personal TV monitor at whatever your own thing is, right? If you're on the treadmill or if you're on the whatever, people have the their own personal TVs. The room, instead of being a room full of cats doing their own thing and their own headphones and their own little worlds, it was a room as one. Even though we all had our headphones on because that was the only way to hear the televisions, everybody, all the men, all the women, everybody was watching the same thing, was watching the game. People were cheering and ooing and groaning. It was so weird for a gym where everybody was in their own space. But there you go. And you had it as a communal experience at Disney World. Toby, good luck to the family. Enjoy Amtrak on the way home. And thanks for checking in with us.
All right. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
All right. Who else is going to come out and play? Call in and take us on your trip. Call in if you're on vacation right now. Anna is in Paris. Are you really?
I am. I can't believe I'm on the radio with you right now.
I can't believe you're listening to us from Paris. How come?
Well, I just woke up from a nap because I got here at 6:55 in the morning, and I flew all night. I didn't really sleep on the plane, so I listened to the radio. I listened to you to get my day going usually. So I couldn't get any. I couldn't understand any of the radio here.
But you don't get the Paris weather. You just find out it's going to be 90 degrees in New York.
Yeah, well, it is beautiful here, and they're doing construction outside of my. I'm an artist, so I couldn't afford anything fancy, but I've saved up a lot over the past couple months, and I'm here for my own solo art show in Paris.
Yay! What are you
from North Carolina?
Are you doing that today?
No, I hang the work on the 7th, and the show starts the 8th of July through August 7th.
What's your work like?
Oh, it's a little provocative. It's mostly figurative. Pretty colorful and never boring. That's
a little. There's your blurb for your leaflet.
Yeah.
A little provocative.
I'm not the best at talking about it, but
never
boring. I work on that.
And what are you going to do today? What are you going to do today in Paris?
Well, I'm going to walk over to the gallery and see it for the first time, and then I'm going to walk to the Basilica, the Sac de Coeur. I don't speak French, so that was my best
effort. But you're going to see this.
I'm gonna do a lot of walking around and looking at beautiful churches and stuff.
Awesome, Anna. So, have fun. Thanks for checking in. Good morning.
Thank you. Can I mention the gallery name?
Yeah.
It's Nouvelle Organon.
Do you know what street it's on or anything?
It's on Rue Mueller, which I know I'm
M-O-U-L-E-R?
M-U-L-L-E-R.
Okay.
And it's, yeah, the show is starting July 8th, and it'll be up for a month.
For all our other Paris listeners, go see Anna's show. Anna, thanks. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
Stephanie is on vacation, calling in from where? Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I'm in the Sierra Nevada mountains near Auberry, California.
Wow. Where are you specifically right now?
I am in a beautiful house right on the border of the National Forest.
What's it like?
It's serene. Probably at night a little, I wouldn't say scary, but I hear rattlesnakes sometimes, which is, you know, not what you hear in Long Island.
Do they actually rattle?
Yes. Yes, they do.
So at least they warn you.
True, and those days I stay inside.
And how come you're listening to this show out there?
Well, I'm from New York, and I'm a regular listener. I love your show, so I needed to hear it.
I'm honored.
I go online.
What are you going to do today?
Today, I will likely just walk around. I'm in a beautiful grounds and garden and refill the pond and check out to make sure. They've had a drought here for quite some time, so I'm actually...
For about 50 years.
Yeah. You know, checking out house sitting and checking out some plants and making sure they're staying healthy.
I hear that hushed, I'm really in the country tone in your voice. So I hope we don't ruin it for you by being... Manhattan-based public radio. Stephanie, thanks for checking in. Have a great time.
Thank you.
And Glenn, you're on WNYC. Are you on vacation?
Hello.
Hi, Glenn.
Oh, hey.
Where are you?
Yes, we're on the West Side Highway. We just loaded up the car, and we are heading to the White Mountains.
Oh, you're in like the first 5 minutes of your vacation.
We are in the blissful first 5 minutes. We are starting to breathe. We feel like we don't have to rush to be anywhere. And it is the best feeling in the world.
Just wait till you get, if you go to New Hampshire, what are you doing? You're going to go to the Merritt and then 91 and that kind of thing?
Exactly right. We love that ride up 91 up through Vermont. We'll stop in Vermont for lunch. And then we wind up in North Conway, which is, of course, just at the foot of the presidential range, and we're going to hike. We hike every day. We stay in what was a very rich person's summer cottage, which has been converted into a beautiful bed and breakfast. They provide terrific breakfast and dinner, and so we hike all day, come back to a nice dinner. They have a hot tub and a swimming pool, and so we run it during the day, but at night we treat ourselves. And then we get up the next day and we do it all over again.
I love that drive, especially when you get north of Hartford. It takes a while because you have to get, but once you get,
know the drive.
I do actually know that drive. Well, my son went to college in New Hampshire, so I did it a lot. And so it takes until you get north of Hartford. But then once you get north of Hartford, all of a sudden it's like, and it's so quiet out there.
My wife and I had the same conversation this morning. Once you pass that Hartford complex, and then you start to get into southern Vermont. It is just, it's like nothing else in the world. We love that part of the world. We go up to the White Mountains regularly.
Who's in the car with you? Who's in the car with you? Just your wife? Just two of you?
I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit, but
all right.
We're going to listen to you all the way up.
Glenn, have a great time. Thanks for checking in. Casey's calling from Berlin. Do I have that right, Casey?
Yeah. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Casey. Where are you right now?
I'm sitting in the hallway of my apartment so that I can be closer to the internet router because I'm calling from Skype because the internet in my really old apartment walls doesn't go through that well. So even though I live in just a one big room studio, the connection's really bad on the other side of a thick wall because this building's from like 18 something.
And what are you going to do today?
Later today I'm going to go to this place called the Wagenplatz, which is like a wagon community in the middle of a forest, in the middle of the city in Berlin, because some friends live there and there's a film festival and it's summer in Berlin, so you get hours upon hour of sunlight. The sun doesn't go down until like 11.
And why are you listening to the show there in Berlin? Why aren't you listening to some kind of German radio?
Well, there is NPR Berlin, but my radio doesn't get the signal. And I listen to my dad on the radio on WINS every day on the internet. And I listen to my brother on KQED on the internet. And I listen to you on the internet because it's nice to be here, but also be home at the same time.
Totally cool. Casey, have fun in Berlin today. And thanks to all of you for calling from all corners of the world, from all elevations, it sounds like, from all different modes of transportation. That was fun for me. I hope it was fun for everybody to listen to. Thanks for taking us on your trip if you're on vacation right now. It's our family meeting. It's our family meeting on travel on The Brian Lehrer Show. Up next, your stories of traveling while black or brown.
Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again.
Thanks, Willie. Now a call in on race and travel. Sometimes as a tourist or a traveler, you can really blend in to the place you're visiting. Sometimes you stand out. And sometimes, as many of you have experienced, I'm sure, race makes it more complicated. Or maybe it makes it less complicated than being black or brown in the United States. So we're opening up the phone lines for any of you who have had experiences traveling outside the United States while black or brown, 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. What was it like if you, let's say, you're African-American and you'd never been to Africa before? How heavy was that to be in that milieu, just in terms of the way people looked or the way people reacted to you? How different from your day-to-day experience in the United States? Did you feel more African roots identified or more American? Like, I'm really different from these people. 212-433-WNYC, or if you were in Europe, how many artists in the 20th century especially wrote about being black and working in Europe? Because even though the populations were majority white, that was where they were taken as individual human beings rather than a black person. So what's it been like for you as a black or brown American traveling abroad? Good, bad, weird, indifferent, whatever, 212-433-WNYC. We have two links to essays up on our website right now. One is from Farai Shadeya, who works with us sometimes, who wrote a piece for the New York Times called Traveling While Black, inspiration there. Another is from the blog Racialicious, titled Brown and Out of Town, A Person of Color Traveler's Guide to Racism by Wendy Muse. And the comedian Hari Kondabolu, you know him? Has a story about being identified more as an American, he's an Indian American, while on a trip.
I've been traveling all over the world telling jokes. I was doing a show in Denmark last year, but I got heckled in a way I'd never been heckled before. A man got up in the middle of my show, and he interrupted, and he said, "Hey, go back to America."
Wow.
It's amazing. It's amazing, because I've been told to go back to so many countries, and never to America. I've been told Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, whatever country we're bombing, I'm told to go back there.
Hari Kondabolu. And joining us as your calls are coming in is Tracy Coleman, who writes for Clutch and does the Brooklyn Travel Addict blog. Hi, Tracy. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Good. And you've traveled widely yourself?
I have traveled definitely widely for a very long time. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Tell me a story. Pick any one.
Oh, gosh. I think a funny story today. I thought I was going to die. I think I was in Tanzania, which was my second trip to Africa, and I did a safari trip. And, you know, we chose to do the tented camp, which, you know, they say stay, you know, out in the wild, close to the animals. I'm like, great, let's do it. So we're there, and they tell you, you know, the sound of the lions, and they don't sound like what you see in the movies. It actually sounds like a monkey. So they teach you early before sunset what that sounds like. So about, I don't know, 9 or 10 p.m. when we're getting ready for bed in our tent, I hear that sound. And the sound was so close that it wasn't like in the distance, like, oh, there's lions like in the distance. No, there's a lion right outside my tent. And so at that point, I was deathly afraid. That was going to be my last day on Earth. And honestly, it's funny now. I laugh now because they weren't interested in me or my friend I was with. They were interested in each other. So there were two lions talking to each other right outside our tent, as in I'm by the kitchen and they are by the couch in the living room. That's how close they were. So it was funny. I was horrified. I was holding onto my pillow. It was crazy. They went away after 5 minutes. But that was one moment that I look back on and I would totally do it again. But at the time, it was pretty horrifying. And it's cool because everybody thinks that dangerous animals are sort of out to eat them or kill them. And a lot of times you're just kind of in their living room and they're wondering what you're doing there. So that's kind of what my experience was.
That's a story. That's a scary story. How about for you as an African-American traveling in Africa when you meet the people there? Like, do you feel, I was posing the question before, you know, do you feel a deep sense of roots, or do you feel like, oh, I'm an American in a really in a place that's really, really different, and the people here are really, really different? How does that, I don't know how many African countries you've been to, but how does that tend to go for you?
I have been to two African countries. So I've been to Tanzania, as I spoke about, and I've been to Ghana. Ghana was first. And actually, they were very different experiences for me. I think in Ghana, which was my first trip, I expected to feel, I expected to be more different. You know, I'm coming from the U.S., and I think, oh, this is going to be different. I'm also really into, like, you know, really cool. I have a big afro myself, so I'm like, oh, it's going to be all this, you know, natural hair styles and that sort of stuff, and they're going to be so different from Americans. When I got there, I found that, you know, and again, it has a lot to do with, you know, just like in America, you're dealing with people who have more income versus people who don't have as much. Right. So I was visiting people who had more income, so that level of culture in Ghana, to me, reminds me of the U.S. a lot. Even more so, I mean, they have butlers, a lot of people have, you know, drivers and that sort of thing. So for me, who doesn't have those things in the U.S., I was actually kind of shocked, like, wow, like, you, people think of Africa being one way, and that's not necessarily the case, and it really depends on what country you're in. So for me, I was shocked more so at how similar we were. Mm-hmm. You know, they were asking me about the latest Jay-Z video, and they're talking about Beyonce, and they listen to the same music and talk about the same designer clothes as we have. And I think that, you know, those similarities to me were more striking than our differences. A lot of the same, especially in pop culture, the interests are all the same if you're about the same age. And in Tanzania, it was different because the level of poverty was so high, then I did feel different. I felt like an American, privileged American, riding around sort of in this safari excursion sort of thing. And the people we saw that were there, I mean, were living literally in huts. And so that's a bigger difference. Granted, our skin tone may be close, but our situations are very different. And so I think it really depends on what country you're going to in Africa, because it's so, you know, so big, so different.
Let's hear from some of our callers. Kim in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kim. Thanks so much for calling up.
Hi, good morning.
What trip do you want to tell us about?
I want to tell you about my trip to China.
Uh-huh.
As an African American, I've traveled a lot of places and never had any problems. But in China, especially in Beijing, I was an alien. They just stared at everyone stared at me no matter where I went. But the funniest part of that is that I have large breasts, and you know, Chinese people are quite, on the whole, smaller than I am, and they couldn't decide what to look at, whether my face or my chest. And I would walk down the street, and I would see people looking up and down, trying to figure out what was stranger to them, and my breasts won every time.
Thank you for being black and buxom in China. Cheryl in Islip, you're on WNYC. Hi, Cheryl.
Yes, good afternoon. Great show today.
Thank you.
I just wanted to talk about my ongoing experience going back and forth to Ireland, how greatly I'm treated as opposed to in the USA, even in the airport. And my husband is Irish, and I'm West Indian American. We have a son, and, of course, he's bicultural. And every time we're in school in Ireland or even England sometimes, when you have to do the project of drawing your family for each other, they draw him with a peach, light peach color crayon. And then when we come to the USA and he's in class, they color him in with a brown crayon.
Huh.
And he came home and he told me, he said, "Mom, why do they do that when I'm in the USA, but in Europe, they're coloring me within a peach color crayon, light peach?" And I had to, unfortunately, explain it to him because I've tried to, it may be unfortunate, but I tried to keep that away from him, especially because we spend more time in Europe, about how the differences is here and ongoing it is. And I had to explain the history of the USA and how it is. But that's constantly a situation when we're back in Europe. I'm American. He's Irish. His father's Irish. And then when he comes here, he's just black.
Do you think that the crayon story actually reflects that the people in Ireland are seeing his skin tone visually in a more nuanced, maybe even more accurate way? Because he's not just a black person, but they're saying, "Oh, that skin tone, yeah, it's kind of matches this one of my 64 crayons."
Honestly, they're coloring him a light peach, which of course is much more closer to their color. And then here they're coloring him brown because, unfortunately, with the history we have in this country, one drop. Even I've read a book called One Drop, and
sure,
there's several stories about when you're bicultural, meaning black and white, you're black because it's, what is it, 1/8%, then you're black.
Right.
So yeah,
white Americans see him as more different, and the Irish people saw him as more like them. That's fascinating. Cheryl, thank you very much. Dax in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dax.
Hi, good morning. How's it going?
Good. What travel story do you want to tell us?
When I lived in Germany for 3 years, and I never really experienced any racism or anyone being hostile towards me. But what I found interesting was I'm African-American, and when I would be, like, walking down the street or something here in the States, you know, if I saw another black person, we would kind of give each other, you know, a heads up or, "Hey, how's it going?" Kind of nonverbal communication. Whereas when I was in Germany with actual Africans that lived there, when I would walk by walk on the street and we'd walk by each other, it would kind of just was like, it's just, we were just normal people. And there wasn't that kind of camaraderie, in a sense of like that kind of nonverbal communication, like that "what's up" kind of, experience. And I just thought that was interesting, because obviously Africans in Germany didn't have the experiences as we did as African-Americans, our brothers and sisters did here in the States. And that's kind of what I took from that.
And yet there's a lot of, there are neo-Nazis in Germany. I don't mean to paint Germans today with a broad brush, but I mean, there's plenty of looking at people from Eastern Europe like, "We don't want you here." And I wonder how the African immigrants get seen by the white Germans in Germany, you know, kind of compared to blacks in this country and white Americans. I don't know if you were there long enough to get a sense.
Yeah, I didn't see that, but I do know that there is a high Turkish population in Germany, and I noticed that a lot of people had some bitter feelings towards the Turkish folks there. So maybe that would be maybe something similar, I guess.
Dax, thank you for checking in. Some tweets along these lines. Chris tweeted, "Interracial couple driving through Tennessee, went with open mind, found folks were very kind, smiling, and more integrated than New York and New Jersey." Matt tweeted us, "I'm white, my wife is African. In Savannah, Georgia, an African-American guy screamed at us saying, I was going to ruin her life." Anu tweeted at us, "In Senegal, everyone said I looked like them. I felt loved. In Bali, people said the same thing. In Paris, blatant racism." Dylan is calling in from India. Hi, Dylan. Where in India are you?
Hi, I'm in Bombay, or Mumbai, as some people like to call it.
What do you like to call it?
I like to call it Bombay, but you can get in some arguments if you do that, because officially now it's Mumbai, which is the Marathi name. Local community.
Has pretty much everybody there adapted to that, or do people present it like you just presented it to me? Some say Bombay, some say Mumbai.
see, I mean, I think for a lot of us, Bombay, the word Bombay represents a cosmopolitan, tolerant city, which we would like this city to be, and Mumbai represents kind of the opposite, but officially it's Mumbai, so in when you meet new people, you would be hesitant to call it Bombay, but among your friends and family, it's Bombay.
Thank you. So what's your travel story that pertains to racial perceptions? You have one?
Well, I was, I'm of mixed race. I'm half Indian and half European. And so it's very interesting that, different types of people here in India will perceive me as a foreigner or as an Indian, depending on the situation and depending on where in India it may be. So, I mean, here in Bombay, it's very much a kind of a melting pot of all kinds of different Indian communities and international communities. But if I go to, say, North India, people tend to have lighter skin, then I'm much less likely to be perceived as a foreigner. Whereas in Southern India, or people tend to have much darker skin, there I would be more likely to be perceived as a foreigner. So it's it's interesting. But there is a lot of racism within the country. There's a lot of discrimination against people who have darker skin tones, and against people from the northeast of India who tend to look more East Asian.
How do you get treated differently by the people who see you as an Indian and the people who see you as a foreigner?
Well, I don't know if I mean, it depends. If you're in a sort of a touristy area, they might think of you as a tourist, or they might not address you in Hindi. They might address you in English, let's say. Sometimes it's hard to understand here exactly what is pertaining to your class and what is pertaining to your, ethnic origin or national origin. I think, in many cases, people will see you as a sort of belonging to a higher class if they perceive you as a foreigner, and they might treat you differently for that reason.
Dylan, thank you very much for checking in from,
my pleasure.
I'll say, Bombay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We had the Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie on the show recently, author of the best-selling Americana, and she told us about an experience she had traveling in the U.S. when a cashier asked her which salesperson had helped her out.
And so the cashier said, "Was it the one with the long hair?" And I said, "Well, both had long hair." "Was it the one in black?" And I said, "Both were wearing black." And I realized, why can't she just say the obvious, which is, was it the white one or the black one?
Would that be easier in Nigeria?
In Nigeria, race is not, it's not a social reality, because most of us are black, so race is not an identity marker.
But if there was a white person there, you wouldn't feel
so. If there was a white person, Nigerians would not at all be shy to say that's the white person.
On our show, the author of Americana, the Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie from a few months ago. So Tracy Coleman from Clutch, what do you think about that clip based on your own travel experiences, and how about all those callers?
Oh, wow. I mean, those are actually some really awesome stories, and I think the interesting thing to me is the difference in, sometimes you feel in the U.S. you may feel your race a lot more than you feel it in other countries, and I've had actually the same sort of experience in my travels.
Tracy Coleman writes for Clutch and does the Brooklyn Travel Addict blog. Thanks for traveling along with us as we heard these callers of all kinds of backgrounds calling about traveling while black or brown outside the United States. Tracy, thanks a lot.
No problem. Thank you.
It's our family meeting on travel on The Brian Lehrer Show today. And now, as we continue, a call in for anyone who's ever experienced what we're going to call an epic vacation fail. If you've ever been on a vacation that went terribly, horribly wrong, give us a call now and share a little bit of your story. 212-433-WNYC. You can vent to us if the memory is still fresh and it still pains you somewhat to talk about it, or if it's maybe well into the past and the story has become kind of funny, kind of family lore, whatever. Give us a call and share that story of a vacation that turned into a disaster. Your epic vacation fail story is at 212-433-WNYC 433-9692. Part of what makes it so hard to swallow when a trip does go awry is how you've built it up in your mind, right? You only plan for the good things. You never seem to remember during the planning process how much your kids argue, how and whoever you're traveling with, you and you don't and them don't always see eye to eye on things, how much work it can be, how hard and confusing and scary sometimes to travel if you're in an unfamiliar place. Here's a clip from a beloved family vacation movie that pretty much gets it right. This is about 30 seconds from National Lampoon's Vacation, 1983.
In retrospect, it seems like a pretty bad idea driving out. It's been one disaster after another.
Yeah, it's been a real drag, Dad. Maybe we can try it some other time. Wally World's overrated anyway.
What do you think?
I think you're all f***ed in the head. We're 10 hours from the f***ing fun park and you want to bail out. Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun. I'm going to have fun and you're going to have fun. I gotta be crazy. I'm on a pilgrimage to see a moose. Praise Marty Moose.
Praise Marty Moose. Recognize Chevy Chase there. So what was it for you? Were you mugged? Were you rested? Have you ever gotten really, really sick on a trip? Like wind up in the hospital sick with appendicitis or malaria? That was my epic fail story. Went with my one-year-old to Florida. We were just going to relax, go to some Mets spring training games in Port St. Lucie, and he got some awful stomach bug and wound up in some godforsaken rural hospital in Florida for 3 days. There went the baseball. There went not worrying about whether my son was going to survive our vacation. He was all right after that, but epic vacation fail. How about yours? 212-433-WNYC. We'll take your calls after this.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again.
On our family meeting about travel on the Brian Lehrer Show, we are also collecting your photos. What's the best travel photo you have that's sitting on your cell phone? We know you have them, and we're going to build a crowdsourced, non-boring vacation slideshow. Scroll back through your camera roll and find the best travel photo sitting on your phone. Tweet it at Brian Lehrer or post it on Instagram using the hashtag WNYCTravel. That's WNYC Travel on Instagram. And you can find some of our favorites already up on the website at WNYC.org. So our family meeting on travel will last after we get off the air in about 25 minutes. We will build a little bit of crowdsourced, non-boring, we promise, vacation slideshow. Scroll back through your camera roll and find the best travel photo sitting on your phone. Post it to Twitter or Instagram using the hashtag WNYCTravel. As for your vacation fail stories, Abigail in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Abigail.
Hi. I went surfing in Indonesia and I broke my jaw.
Oh, my goodness.
But it was actually kind of cool. It was the last week, but prior to that, I had a horrible stomach virus. And then it happened the last week, so I just, like, hung out. We checked into the Hard Rock. We checked out of our $5 a day place and went to the Hard Rock for the last week. And I watched the History Channel, and this thing about Caligula came on and how they, like starved his uncle and he went insane and ate his mattress. So I knew that my jaw was going to be wired for 6 months and that I was going to, 6 weeks rather, and I was going to go insane. So, but it actually turned out to be okay because I just came back to New York and sat in my apartment and got really into The Sopranos and Six Feet Under.
How did you get your jaw? Did you get into a bar fight or something?
No, I was surfing.
Oh.
I was surfing.
How does it happen when you're surfing? How does your jaw get broken surfing?
The waves were closing out. That means they're not, like, curling. So I was surfing, showing off, like, to some guy that wasn't paying any attention and surfing beyond my ability. The waves were too big. They weren't really surfable. and like it, the wave went up really high and it wasn't closing out. And so I just aborted, I just jumped off the board and I was sitting in the ocean and I'm like, where's the board? And the board swung around and hit me in the jaw like a 2x4.
Oh, it was the board. Wow.
It was really intense.
Keyword, showing off for some guy who wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, and so it was really good. It happened when I was 31. So I came back to New York and was like, you know what? I'm really ready to commit to my career. And I'm not like, you know, I'm not going to let my ego, you know, hurt me or get in the way. And I'm not.
And I'll settle down with that nice nerdy guy who's been pursuing me.
And watch The Sopranos.
There you go. So when you think of Indonesia, are you like, Indonesia, or do you kind of get a laugh out of it now, or what?
When I think of Indonesia, I'm like, I really love traveling, and it was really beautiful, but I kind of can't do third world countries anymore because the begging and, like, the starving, you know, animals and the sick animals and, like, the children sleeping on the side of the road, that was kind of too much.
Abigail, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vincenza in Larchmont, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You have an epic travel fail story?
Me and my family, we were planning a wonderful trip to Sicily. We had never been there, and my husband's family was from there, so we couldn't wait to go. So we booked the trip online. And online, the pictures looked stunning, and it was this little cottage on the beach, and you can walk to the town. And after traveling, you know, 9 hours on the plane, then we had to take a little plane to a little town near Sicily, and then we had to drive another 2 hours, and we get to this place, and it was in this, you couldn't walk anywhere. It was down this steep hill, and yes, it was on the ocean, but it was so desolate. It looked like an ocean town that had been once vibrant. Everything was boarded up, and it was actually scary because there was nothing around. So we go into the little cottage, and there was a sign. There was no running water. There was a sign that said, please be careful of carbon monoxide poisoning, so keep the windows open, keep the window a little bit open. And the ceiling fan was literally hanging out, hanging from the ceiling. And as they're spinning, they look like they want to fall out of the ceiling. The towels in the bathroom look like, in Italian, mappinas, which are old rags that you use constantly, and you could never possibly dry yourself with the towels.
And was this sold to you as like a 5-star accommodation or something?
Well, I don't know if I want to say 5-star, but it was sold to us as this beautiful resort area, and it was so not that. So my husband literally dropped his head, put his hands in his head. He couldn't take it because we've been on such a long journey. And we just all looked at each other and said, we're out of here.
And did you leave or did you find a way to have a good time there? Where'd you go?
We left. We got in our car. We didn't know where we were going because we were in Sicily. And we just drove around. And literally we turned a corner and wound up in this beautiful beachfront area in front of a 4-star hotel, literally, just making some turn somewhere after driving about a half hour, and it just had a happy ending and turned out to be a beautiful trip, and we did get our money back
your money. And you had the money, and they had the space for you to stay in that nice hotel.
Yes, they did.
Good.
It all worked out beautifully, it was interesting and actually funny now.
That's a moment. Vincenza, thank you very much. Susan in Ardsley, you're on WNYC. You have an epic vacation fail story?
It's a fail story / survival story.
Okay.
In about 1986, I went on a trip with my mom and her boyfriend, and we were traveling to Costa Rica to visit his adult sons that lived in Quepos. They have houses near the rainforest. So we first flew into San Jose, and then we took a little flight to Quepos. Our bags went to San Jose, California.
Oops.
And for the entire vacation, I had absolutely nothing to wear. So we simply borrowed a pair of flip-flops and a pair of shorts that didn't really fit me, a muscle T-shirt. The worst was that packed in my bags was my anxiety medication, which was meant to help me with the scariest mammal of all, my mother. But what I will say
is that it was a fantastic vacation because I couldn't care less what I looked like, and instead I was able to focus on the beauty of the Costa Rica. And remember that the mammals there, the gorgeous monkeys, the worker ants that are carrying 10 times their weight on their back of leaves, could not have cared less what I was wearing. And I didn't even need my medication. So it was really a wonderful lesson in how sometimes less is more.
It's the only country outside the United States that I've traveled to twice. I love Costa Rica. In fact, I'm now officially rooting for them in the World Cup.
Yes,
now that
too.
The United States has been eliminated. Susan, thank you for telling us that story. And our producer, Jody Avergan, who's from Costa Rica, has posted on our site, if anybody wants to read it, 7 reasons to root for Costa Rica in the World Cup now that the United States has been eliminated. So go see that at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Partha in Livingston, you have an epic travel fail story?
Yes, actually I was robbed in Paris, and earlier in the program somebody was narrating that she's in France, in Paris. So I just wanted to say that if you are a tourist, be extra protective, be careful, because these gypsies or Bedouins and pickpockets are everywhere in near Eiffel Tower, near all the great museums, and they prey on the kindness of people. So they came as, you know, in the disguise of, you know, helping blind disabled children. And when I gave a €2 note, the others ganged up on me and removed a $50 euro bill from my wallet. Now, I was aware that this might happen, so I stuffed some of the euros somewhere else so I could take a cab and reach home. Otherwise, I would have been in big trouble. And this is a warning to all the tourists that if, you know, try not to be overgenerous,
right.
Be protective.
Not be overgenerous by accident. Partha, thank you very much. I will assume that you meant gypsy in a figurative way. But, of course, I tell my son, who's a teenager, if he goes to do things around town, the most dangerous places in New York in terms of losing your stuff are the tourist areas. You're going to get pickpocketed if you go to Times Square, not if you go to, you know, a neighborhood in the Bronx. Yes, go to a tourist area in Paris or New York or anywhere and make sure you don't keep your wallet in your back pocket. Igor in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Igor.
Hi, how are you? So my story is basically almost 25 years ago. It's 91, Soviet Union collapsing. They opened the borders, and me and my girlfriend, out of a military academy, she's already a grown-up doctor. She was older than me. We decided to go to Europe, drive through the whole Europe and just go through mom and pop's, you know, hotels. And we in Italy on one of the mountain roads, and the accident happens in front of us. And she's a doctor. I'm kind of military. We know some things, how to help people. So the lady got broken leg and the bones are sticking out. The guy has got a fractured skull. The kid is hurt too. So we helped them stop the bleeding, did everything like we're supposed to. Carabineros showed up on the helicopter. They're not even looking at our patients. They go straight to us asking if we are doctors, not even listening to our, at that time, bad English. And they just arrested us and put us in jail because basically we weren't qualified to do any medical procedures in Italy, and we broke the law. So we spent almost a week in an Italian prison until Russian consul bailed us out and paid the fee.
That is an epic fail, winding up in jail. Did you at least get medical care?
We didn't get hurt. The people in front of us, we just helped them because it was a mountain road.
Yes.
We basically, the accident blocked the road from both sides.
No good deed went unpunished in the case of Igor in Brooklyn. Igor, thank you very much. And those are your stories of epic vacation fails.
All my bags are packed and ready to go. I'm still
sitting here outside the door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. Taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again.
It's our family meeting on Travel on the Brian Lehrer Show today, and here's the trip we've been on so far. We asked you to complete the sentence, it's not a trip unless. We talked about race and travel, travel epic fails, travel as pilgrimage or quest. And we end our journey with a look at what it means to travel in a responsible manner. What defines travel ethics for you? Where did you go or where wouldn't you go because of your ethical standards? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Where did you go or where wouldn't you go because of your ethical standards, standards for responsible travel? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. With us for this is Martha Honey, co-director of the Center for Responsible Travel. She's also the author of several books about the topic, including Ecotourism and Sustainable Development, second edition, Who Owns Paradise? Hi, Martha Honey. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Brian.
So some basic areas of concern, culture, economy, environment. Are those the big three when people ask themselves, am I traveling responsibly?
Yes, I think that definitely are the big three. I would add maybe two others. One is political sensitivity, and I think that's really what you were asking your listeners to think about. Should you travel to certain places or should you not travel to certain places because of the political climate? For instance, there was an international boycott against apartheid South Africa, and until recently against Burma. So I think that, you know, it's important to be aware of what local democratic forces in the country are calling for and to think carefully if they're calling for a boycott about whether or not you really want to go there.
For you, how much let me jump in on that a little bit, because much of a political outlier or a human rights abuser does a country have to be by your lights or by whatever general standards of responsible travel are? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, every country does something. There are people who might not go to the United States because of what we do around the world, if they wanted to go by that. So where do you draw the line? Where might one draw the line for themselves?
Right. And this is a really good question, not easy answers, but I think that one benchmark is what are the democratic movements in those countries calling for, because in some cases tourism is so important to the country that it's going to hurt common people if there's a boycott. And so I think in what we saw in Burma, Aung San Suu Kyi's organization had called for a boycott, international boycott, as a way of putting pressure on the military dictatorship. The same with the ANC in South Africa. So I think that those are, for me at least, that's something to look at. What are the forces of what we might call the forces of good, the forces mm-hmm. of democratic change in the country? What are they saying?
Let's take a call. Stephanie in Fairfield. You're on WNYC. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's responsible travel for you? What's the story?
The responsible travel for me is generally researching where you should and should not go. For my case, I would say that my were getting married, and I think that for us, we wanted to research and make sure that we were going to a vacation spot tolerant and safe for us to go to.
As because your phone broke up for a minute, you were saying you're in a gay marriage, right?
Yes, we're getting married in 2 weeks.
Yes, congratulations. So you want to make sure it's LGBT friendly, not just for your own pleasure, but to support countries that are forward looking that way, right?
Well, to support them and just make sure that, you know, nothing happens to us on our own.
Yes.
Making sure that it's safe for us to go to.
Thank you. Allison in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Allison.
Hi. Yeah, I go to Africa a lot, and recently
there have been a lot of organizations setting themselves up that claim to be involved in conservation. There are a lot of places where you can walk with lions, for example. And actually, most of those lions never return to the wild. And they're really just a way to offer tourists an experience that they market as being involved with conservation. So that's the kind of thing that I would not do on vacation. And I think very carefully about visiting places that work with animals and check them out before you go.
Allison, thank you. And Martha Honey, that gets to the whole big question of ecotourism. And how do we know when something really is ecotourism in the sense of being actually sustainable and when it's not?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is within the tourism movement, within tourism, a movement towards certification programs that measure the environmental, social, and economic impacts of tourism. And several countries in Africa, for instance, South Africa and Kenya, have what we can call green certification programs. So I think looking where these programs exist, looking for companies that have been certified under them is one way. I think that the callers raises a really important question about Africa. I mean, I think it's extremely important for travelers to be supporting the big game parks in Africa, the ones that the governments have set aside and are internationally recognized, rather than these sort of private zoos that people have set up and are marketing as kind of upscale, so-called ecotourism. I think, you know, we really need to be putting resources into supporting the big game parks that need funding, because they're oftentimes in countries that are have high levels of poverty, and are really important to all of us, to all of humankind, to make sure that these parks survive.
How about the travel itself, carbon footprint, in taking into account, you know, whether
right.
your trip is sustainable or not. I first met you, as you know, I'll tell our listeners this story, when you were a journalist in Costa Rica, and I went for 10 days on what they called an eco tour. I was with a group on a bus seeing the national parks and other parts of the country and split off for an afternoon to meet you and your husband and talk, you know, Central American politics. And I thought it was ethical travel, but I was on a bus traveling around with other Americans. I flew from here to there and back. I mean, a bus is sustainable travel in New York City rather than a private car. Is a bus sustainable travel on an eco tour in Costa Rica?
I think, yes, definitely it is. Buses, trains, you know, bicycles, walking, all of these are sustainable. The issue of airplanes is tricky. I mean, one of the issues is that many, many third world countries, developing countries, poor countries, are heavily dependent on tourism. So to boycott travel or long-distance travel is really hurting those countries. And also, as I know you experienced in Costa Rica and many people do, travel is a way that we expand our minds and make ourselves more accessible, more sensitive, and so on. So travel is important to human beings as well. So I think we don't want to stop traveling. I say, you know, we sort of have to travel in smarter ways, see if there are more sustainable forms of transport, take planes, but try to take as few as possible, group your travel together, and so on. But I think it's very important that we keep traveling, but try to do it in ways that are more sensitive to the, you know, the environmental realities of the carbon footprint of travel.
David in Lawrence, New Jersey.
And you can offset the travel also by carbon offset programs.
Like what?
So there are a number of programs for carbon offset where you pay a small amount, and that goes into alternative energy or supporting the preservation of a rainforest or whatever. There are a whole host of these programs. We actually have on our website Responsible Travel Tips, and there's a bunch of websites for some of these carbon offset programs on that. Our website is www.responsibletravel.org.
David in Lawrence, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi. A couple of years ago, my wife and I came and discovered a tour to North Korea. And we certainly considered the ethical implications of spending money that would benefit the North Korean regime, but we also considered it a wonderful opportunity to see a forbidden part of the world. And I actually posted on my Facebook page a question to my friends as to whether it would be a good thing to do, the right thing to do, and was overwhelmingly encouraged to do so. I have a pretty adventurous group of friends. But my daughter, who was pregnant at the time and also happens to be a diplomat for the U.S. State Department, strongly discouraged us. She was concerned both of the ethical implications and of being out there in a dangerous part of the world without an American embassy.
What did you finally decide for yourself regarding the ethics?
What we finally decided regarding the ethics was the amount of money that we thought would go to that regime would be so small compared to the opportunity for education of ourselves and the cross-cultural understanding of it. So we actually had put down a deposit when our daughter basically said she didn't want to give birth and have her parents in a North Korean labor camp. So that sort of trumped the decision.
I guess so. David, thank you very much. I mean, people sometimes go to countries specifically to make a statement, right? Didn't Mayor de Blasio and his wife honeymoon in Cuba? And I guess that made a certain kind of, I think I'm remembering that right. So is it ethical travel? I mean, the whole topic of ethical travel, Martha, it seems to me, we've got about a minute left in the show. It's so much about what not to do. Is it also about what to do?
Good point. I mean, I would say just personally with Cuba, I think that there's never been, except for the U.S. State Department, the Cubans have not been calling for, including, you know, some of the opposition forces there have not been calling for a boycott. And I think that it can be a real learning experience. I would say the same, you know, with North Korea. I think we have to make our own decisions. The State Department has put controls on travel to several countries, North Korea, Cuba, and a couple of others. But I think we have to, you know, it can be a tremendous learning experience. And these are countries oftentimes we know so little about that, as the caller said, it can help to, you know, to educate both the traveler but also their circle of their Facebook circle of friends and so on. So I think about it, but I think, you know, oftentimes it you should go.
Martha Honey, co-director of the Center for Responsible Travel, author of books including Ecotourism and Sustainable Development, second edition, Who Owns Paradise? Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that is our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on travel.
We're the best of friends. Wait to get on the road again. The life I love is made.